Hey, Corey, I've got a quiz for you.
Okay.
Okay, so, three questions. Who's more influential? Maggie Thatcher or Tony Blair?
Well, always been a fan of Tone, as you know. But surely it has to be Thatcher who's more influential.
Clement Attlee or Beveridge?
Well, I suppose Beveridge came up with the idea, but...
Attlee implemented it.
So, probably Attlee.
Okay, yeah, no, that's fair. I can see where you're coming from with that. Screaming Lord Such of the Monster Raving Loony Party or the entirety of the Green Party?
That's ridiculous. It must be the Green Party. They're a national party. They've got MEPs. They've got an MP. They've got thousands of members. Was Screaming Lord Such... Did he ever get more than 1,000 votes in any election he ever stood
no,
for?
No. Screaming Lord Such very rarely got many votes at all. But he's actually had a string of policies enacted through other governments, actually.
Really?
Yes. Pet passports, 24-hour drinking, lowering the voting age to 18, the abolition of dog licences, you know, the legalisation of commercial radio, abolishing the 11+. There's actually a string of policies which Screaming Lord Such and the Monster Raving Loony Party in particular have advocated over the years, which have all gone on to be implemented by governments. And the Greens have achieved what in terms of policy?
Well,
their policies in particular. Can you name any?
Pet passports, was that one of theirs?
That's one of Screaming Lord Such's.
a green investment bank? No.
But this is quite an interesting little thing that we've got here, is that... arguably, you could say that the Screaming Lord Such and the Monster Raving Loony Party have been more influential on British politics than the Green Party have, which I know sounds ridiculous, but that's kind of one way you can view it, especially if you're viewing politics through the notion of the only thing that matters is winning in an election
so,
and getting things done.
I suppose maybe British politics, there's probably a lot of environmental regulations that we don't have anymore because we're leaving the EU. But there's a lot of stuff that happens in Brussels that we don't hear about that maybe the Greens have proposed.
It's entirely possible, but I think the question that this kind of poses is that what makes a successful political party or politician in the 21st century? It's clearly not just about implementing your policies, because otherwise we'd be viewing Screaming Lord Such as being more influential than Caroline Lucas, and yet we would never think of that. So that's what this episode of Not Enough Champagne is about. We're going to be talking about what it means to be politically successful. And we'll be delving into a wonderful little thing known as the Overton Window.
Yeah, the Overton Window was developed by a guy called Mr. Window, wasn't it, in the 1990s?
Yes, Mr. Window. The Overton Window is, I suppose, a kind of a way of viewing debate. The notion is that you imagine a window, and within that window you've got a load of ideas of which are acceptable for discussion. And out on each side of the window you've got the ideas which exist and are kind of part of the discourse, but are not considered acceptable by the mainstream. Now, the notion is that if you can change or move what's acceptable, you can shift that window to it so that it includes more of your beliefs and the kind of ideas that you want to see put forward versus your opposition's, you'll be able to get much more done.
So almost, it's like that thing, is it Martin Luther King who says that first they laugh at you and then they respect you and then you win? It's... that your policy can become unthinkable. It's unthinkable, then it's radical,
cool.
then acceptable, then sensible, then popular, then it becomes policy.
Yes, yeah. That's okay. The exact kind of thinking behind this. And you can see some wonderful examples of kind of politicians actually shifting the Overton window. Up until 1979, there were the notion of what the welfare state should be and kind of what government should do was pretty well established between Labour and the Conservatives. Whilst they differed on their approach to a number of different things, The core notion was that government would do roughly the same sorts of things.
Mm.
Then Maggie Thatcher gets elected in 1979 and everything changes. We get the first kind of real kind of cutbacks to government expenditure happening in, for the first time really in decades.
I suppose it's interesting that's how she shifts it to Thatcherite ideas as well, because you could argue the post-war consensus breaks down when James Callaghan says you can't spend your way out of a recession. And that's maybe the ending of that consensus. But no one then was talking about any of the privatisation, any of the Thatcherite policies that she was talking about until she wins that election in 79.
Absolutely. So Maggie Thatcher shifts the frame of the debate when she's in power and starts kind of changing what is acceptable policy. Perhaps best summarised, actually, by the 1983 general election with Labour's longest suicide note in history.
Mm.
Now, when you compare what that manifesto said compared to what previous Labour governments and previous Labour manifestos had said, yes, it was more left-wing, but it was not so radically more left-wing than Attlee. But they took a thrashing like no other. In fact, still is, I think, the worst electoral defeat they've ever had.
At the moment?
Currently, yeah. There's still time for that to change. After Foot, you've got Kinnock, who spends his entire time trying to move away from militant.
Hmm.
You've then got Smith, who's moderate. Obviously, sadly, John Smith dies before the election and never becomes Prime Minister. Replaced by Tony Blair. And I say this is someone who likes Tony Blair, continues much of the kind of the Thatcherite consensus in a number of ways. And then Gordon Brown, who does the same thing. And then, of course, Cameron. So Maggie Thatcher, very good at shifting that Overton window.
I mean, I think we're both fans of Blair, despite everything. But you can see why Cameron and Osborne in particular are quite big fans of Blair, because he's able to detoxify Labour and able to win a thumping victory when they're thinking about trying to change the Tory party, when they're trying to make the Tory party more electable, that Blair is their model rather than Thatcher. Whereas Ed Miliband always talked about trying to be more like a Thatcher figure, but didn't really seem to... He was always very quite strategically bold, but he was quite tactically weak in how he was actually going to go about doing so. Yep. And trying to shift the window.
Absolutely. So my next question to you is, given that we've established that Thatcher shifted the window, Miliband failed to, how do you do it? What's the best way to actually kind of making those changes?
Well, I mean, we talked about the Green Party at the start of the podcast.
Yep.
And there's a definite turning point, you can say, when the Green Party shifted the Overton window. That's 1989. In the European elections, 2 million people voted Green. 15% of the population is, I think, still probably one of the biggest results.
Yeah, it's the highest electoral percentage they've received.
The Green, they were first past the post, so the Greens got stuffed. I think they maybe got one MEP or something. But in response to that, in 1990, all three main political parties, the Tories and the Liberals and Labour, they all issue environmental white papers, and there's more emphasis on green issues in all the manifestos and the parties in 1992. Now, all the parties talk about environmental power, even if they don't necessarily act upon it. I mean, a lot of the greenest government ever things have been shown to be a bit of a sham. In a short answer to your question, then, you get it. But if you're a small party, you get it by winning lots of votes, in which case parties tend to co-opt your agenda. If you're a big political party, you do it by... Thatcher did it by getting a network together, think tanks like the Adam Smith Institute, people like Keith Joseph, who were able to disseminate her ideas. But she couldn't actually shift that window until she won an election and was able to put her policies into practice.
Yeah, I think that's probably quite an accurate portrayal of the ways to shift the window. So basically it boils down to two ways to do it. You can win an election and then kind of input your plans, which then changes the context where debates are happening. Or you need to find a way to frame the debate in some way, whether that be winning a large number of votes, as the Greens did, or via some other means. You know, there are ways that you can frame the debate so that it can be very beneficial to your cause, and it will make some things more... you know, palatable to the wider public.
And Blair does this too. I mean, there's two probably main things that happen in his administration where you can tell the window has shifted. One of them was the minimum wage. You can see there we've got the living wage now, which would not have happened without the minimum wage. The other thing is same-sex marriage, which again is probably one of the big successes of Cameron's premiership. Probably wouldn't have happened without Tony Blair. So again, we've talked about Blair not really shifting the Overton window. He doesn't really. He carries on that kind of more neoliberal consensus. But there's a couple of areas where it definitely did shift.
Yeah, I would say he on a load of kind of more cultural issues, he definitely did shift things in towards a more liberal direction. And I think one of the things that bears in mind is as much as we talk about an Overton window or the Overton window in terms of what's acceptable and what's not, actually it's not just one window. There's an entire house filled with these windows. Mm.
Maybe what's interesting is it almost doesn't matter then what the response of the opposition party is, because then Attlee wins in 45. The Conservative Party, they adapt pretty damn quickly to that new agenda. They win, they're back in power within 6 years. You alluded to the fact that Labour have their suicide note in 83. The Conservative Party can't really they oppose the minimum wage when it's first brought in, and it takes, you know, two general election losses before they start responding. I find it interesting that it doesn't almost matter what the opposition party do. As soon as you've won that election, the debate is changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is quite an interesting facet of all of this, is that once you do shift that window, it's very hard to shift it back. With all this in mind, to give this kind of debate a bit more of a more relevant feel to it, given what we've discussed about the Overton window, does this mean that Jeremy Corbyn can be a success?
I think there's three ways he can do it. Mm-hmm. One of them is that he does a George McGovern or a Labour in 83. He fights an election on a far left ticket and he loses badly, and those ideas are consigned to the dustbin. The second way is he wins the general election, and maybe the Overton window then shifts. If it happens, I don't think it will, but if it does, then the neoliberal consensus, which has kind of been around since Thatcher, shifts massively, and then everything changes because nothing really makes sense. The third way is he becomes a Barry Goldwater or a Bernie Sanders. There's a quote about Goldwater losing in 64, which is that Goldwater did win the 1964 election. It just took 16 years to count the votes. So it could be that although Jeremy Corbyn loses an election, maybe those debates stay in the party and someone else who's better equipped electorally and a better candidate for Prime Minister than Corbyn takes those ideas and runs with them and maybe implements them at a later stage.
Okay, so that's quite interesting that you've identified these three kind of routes. Because at no point in them did you actually mention momentum or any of kind of the grassroots support that Corbyn has, and I think that's quite interesting, because so much of the kind of the rhetoric and the discourse that we have around kind of shifting the Overton window is all about kind of building enough momentum, actually, through kind of popular engagement. You can see it. You saw it during the Labour leadership election, where you've got the likes of Owen Jones, the Guardian journalist, basically saying we need to broaden the debate. We need to bring in Jeremy Corbyn, get him on the ballot, so that we can broaden the debate and actually come up with better ideas to build momentum, so that we can actually shift this Overton window. And the Overton window is something that Owen Jones is quite fond of as a concept. Literally, the name of the group which is supporting Corbyn in the Labour Party is Momentum. The idea is that these are a group of people who can help campaign and build forward and change things and kind of take the message out there, all with the idea of therefore changing the debate. What role then do you think regular people or activists or whatever have in helping shift or frame the debates, and how do they influence the window?
Well, activists have a key role in election campaigning. So just that activism, get out the vote, that leafleting, actual doing politics is something that activists have to do and is crucial. What I think certainly the referendum vote shows, and what the general election last year shows, is the importance of organising, it's the importance of campaigning, it's the importance of getting out the vote. Yes, we've got lots of more people joining political parties after the referendum result. it'll be interesting to see how active they are, I think.
Yeah, that's probably a very valid point. Certainly there's been a lot of evidence in the past that when you have these kind of spikes or surges in political membership, an awful lot of them don't actually become activists. A classic example of this, again, is off the back of the Labour leadership election, where a number of people either signed up as supporters to vote for Jeremy Corbyn or joined to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. And that anecdotally, at least, it seems that these people maybe turn up to one or two things and then they're never heard from again.
I think we've talked before about how these kind of grassroots movements aren't really interested in compromise. And I wonder if maybe grassroots activism isn't something they're particularly interested in because it involves trying to convince people who don't agree with them.
Yeah, I don't think that's an overt reason for it, but I think there might be a kind of an underlying cause to all of that. And I think that kind of links nicely into what will basically be the last thing we discuss on this podcast. A lot of the kind of the momentum kind of type of people are heavily involved in social media. Social media seems to be a way that people are trying to shift the debate quite heavily. We saw it in the 2010 election with the way a lot of Labour kind of supporters were utilising it. A lot of it was just kind of your standard kind of campaigning, but you also had these weird moments of like Ed Miliband fandom where people were kind of really liked Ed Miliband or found him attractive or something. Were kind of gushing about him. There were Tumblr blog posts and accounts just dedicated solely to him, almost as a kind of direct reaction to the way that he was normally kind of seen as this kind of goofy, geeky guy who couldn't eat a bacon sandwich and kind of and was a bit of a robot in his interviews. So, social media, good or bad for shifting the Overton window?
I think as a way of campaigning, it probably isn't a terribly good one. I think either because of who you follow on Twitter and Facebook, or maybe because of the algorithms that Twitter or Facebook has, I think you end up following people who you agree with, or the algorithms give you posts from people who you already agree with, which makes it quite difficult to engage with the other side. I don't think anyone's ever going to change anyone's mind over Twitter. You can't really do doorstep campaigning on it. 140 characters isn't too much to change people's minds, and it just ends up being a bit of a slanging match, I think. I think it's not as good as actually knocking on the doors and talking to people face to face, because if you're wavering and you're not quite sure who to vote for, you're not going to think, oh, well, that party tweeted me, because that's easy. You know, anyone could do that. Whereas actually, if a party's made an effort to see you, to talk to you and engage with you, A, you know it's a local activist. The fact it's a local person makes more of an impact, because it's someone from your local area you can identify with. And I think also the debate online just becomes very partisan and corrupted. And I know we're going to talk about that in later episodes. But I think it's not really a good way generally to get out the vote. You might get a few people, but I don't think it's very useful when you think about actually effective community campaigning.
Okay, so last thing, given everything we've discussed today, that social media not necessarily a kind of a wonderful tool for building momentum, the propensity of groups like Momentum, the group, rather than the concept, for engaging in the way that they do and not necessarily turning up to meetings or becoming those door knockers and becoming those activists. And the notion that perhaps the best way to shift the debate is to get elected. Do you think Jeremy Corbyn will shift the Overton window? Will he make Owen Jones' dreams come true?
I don't know yet whether he'll end up being a Barry Goldwater, Bernie Sanders type who maybe historians will look at and say he shifted the debate. I think Labour would be insane even if they get rid of him as leader, and he's still leader when we're recording. I think Labour would be insane not to change some of their policy positions as a result, whether or not that means they're more likely to get into power. But I think he's certainly shifted it in the Labour Party. Whether or not he'll shift it in the country, I'm not sure, because I don't think Jeremy Corbyn is very interested in winning mass support for his ideas. in terms of winning enough people to get a majority in Parliament. I think he's interested in building a social movement of people who agree with him, but I don't think he's then interested in converting people who don't agree with him to his cause.
Well, with that, we will end this week's edition of Not Enough Champagne with the shocking hot take that Jeremy Corbyn may not be able to shift the Overton window and give us a more left-wing politics in Britain. Please direct all of your abuse at Peter Bone on his Twitter account, because, you know, yelling at him is a hell of a lot more fun than yelling at us. And my name is Steve Haynes. I'm sat here with my partner in propaganda, Corey Hazelhurst. Hello. And we will see you next week.
See you next week.